skies and see how the time goes by. All we can find out is among the tears that will fall when the meadow cries.
Dear ideas, much too much to think of. We need
FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Tonight's show is the 100th installment of Ecotopia. For almost 2 years, we've delighted in exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. We want to thank KZFR, our listeners, our financial supporters, for making this radio program possible.
To celebrate our 100th, we have a special guest interview with Ernest Kallenbach, author of Ecotopia, the book from which our show takes its title.
And we want to once again thank Jim Rias and Connie Fisher for introducing us to the book and to the term Ecotopia.
The book was published in 1975 and became an instant classic in the science fiction and utopian genres. It's set in the not-too-distant future and is based on the premise that Northern California, Oregon, and Washington have seceded from the United States in order to form a more perfect union.
The Ecotopians have tackled a wide range of social, environmental, and economic problems, from food and sewage to energy and pollution to recycling to transportation to education to equality of sex and race.
The novel is told from the point of view of William Weston, a newspaper writer who's the first American permitted into Ecotopia in over 20 years. And the book consists of his journal entries and his dispatches back to his newspaper in the U.S.
Initially skeptical, Weston becomes more and more convinced of the validity and vitality of Ecotopian thinking, and at the end of the novel, he faces a difficult decision whether to return to the United States or to remain in Ecotopia.
And as we used to say in junior high school, you'll just have to read the book for yourselves to find out the answer to that question.
And here's our interview with Ernest Kallenbach, which we recorded at his home 10 days ago.
We're here in Berkeley in the home of Ernest Kallenbach, author of Ecotopia. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps let's begin with the start of Ecotopia. It was published in 1975. It became an instant bestseller and has inspired literally generations of environmentalists and people interested in politics. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to write the book?
Well, I think probably the basic thing is that I wrote it to cheer myself up because, believe it or not, in 1971, when I actually began work on it, it looked like the destruction of the environment by industrial consumer capitalism had gotten to the point where it was really depressing, and whether it would ever be remade or reconstructed or reformed or anything like that was dubious. And so I began to think utopian thoughts, which people do when they get very discouraged about reality. The particular origin, it took about 3 years to write it, because although it's a very short book, it's all very thoroughly researched, and parts were sent out to experts in various fields for review and suggestions and so on. But the actual writing began, and this is very ecotopian, it began through sewage. I was thinking of writing an article, a magazine article called The Scandal of Our Sewage, which was going, I'm a country boy from central Pennsylvania, where everything, we lived on 10 acres and everything was recycled because there was nobody to haul it away. You had to, and a lot of stuff was very useful, agriculturally or otherwise. So it offended me that we were living in a society of, at that time, I don't know, 250 million people, I guess it was, and all our nutrient wastes, really high nutrient content wastes, were being sent down rivers, barged out to sea, burned, whatever. And I was writing this article trying to suggest a way out of this biologically insane pattern, and spending time at the Sanitary Engineering Library of the University of California at Berkeley. Believe it or not, such a thing exists. And I learned that there were two reasons why we didn't treat our bleep, sensibly. Mm-hmm. And one was a real important reason, namely that we allowed industry especially to pour toxics into sewage, so that the sewage system as a whole, if you turned the waste into sludge, you would have a brew that was not terribly healthy for plants. The other thing was that although they've been doing it in Milwaukee since, I think, 1925 or something, it's a tiny bit more expensive to turn sewage into sludge than to dispose of it in these ways we were talking about. So it looked very grim. And then I looked around the world to see whether the Chinese were doing better. At that time, they were purely or almost purely agricultural society, so that wasn't really very much help. And the Cubans, although they had just had a really beautiful little revolution, they weren't doing anything better. And so suddenly this light went on in my head. You never know why these things happen, that if there was no country in the world that treated its sewage intelligently from a biological standpoint, maybe the time had come to invent one. And so I sat down, and the first thing I wrote was the chapter about the recycling of nutrients from food, sewage, back to fertilizer, back to land, and so on, and what the ecotopians, as I began to call them about that time, called a stable state or contained recycling system. And I remember sitting down and looking at that little, it was a little short piece, and I was working all the time as an editor, and I have had family obligations and so on, so I don't have very long stretches in which to write, but I wrote this little thing, and I looked at it and I thought, well, that's kind of cute. Probably any group of people who got it together enough to take care of their sewage would do a lot of other things differently. And so I began thinking about transportation and land use and what kinds of family structures they lived in and how they organized their industries and their their factories, warehouses, everything. What kind of buildings they lived in, and so on. In short, trying to think what people who were biologically responsible, I guess you could call it, what they would change. And as I worked on it, it began to seem, of course, that they would change almost everything, because the way we live now is really idiotic. And I was inspired in this partly by a philosopher whom I had read in college, Count Alfred Korzybski, author of Science and Sanity and the movement then called General Semantics.
General Semantics.
It was very popular when I was a student. And Korzybski had a term that I had somehow stuck in my head, non-survival behavior. Now, individual people do non-survival behavior, for example, by smoking. It may make you look cute, it may be sexy, it may give you a nice buzz, but if you do enough of it, probably it kills you, or at least it makes the chances of your dying prematurely much greater. Well, societies do that too. And all through history, you see the decline or a wreckage of empires or small societies that have done things stupidly, non-survival things stupidly, and taken the consequences. So I wanted to see whether there was a way out of that. We're supposed to be so smart, and we have all this technology and all that. Can we possibly figure out a way to live that would be sustainable? Although the term sustainable does not, I think, occur in the book. At that time, early 70s, it hadn't taken on the meanings that it has now.
Right. I'm curious about, you said that it was very well researched and you sent parts of it off to people to read. I'm curious about maybe some of who the biggest influences on your thinking or who some of the most important sources were as you were looking at all of these various aspects of society that needed to be recreated.
Well, there are some negative influences. I can get those out of the way quickly. Right. I had read B.F. Skinner's book,
yes.
Walden 2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, Skinner was the Harvard professor who taught pigeons to play ping pong, and then he wrote this fantasy about people getting along terribly well because they put everything in the hands of technocrats, essentially, and I thought that was really pretty unlikely. And there is another book, which actually is very well worth reading, I think, called Islandia, like island with IA on the end, by Austin Wright. Austin Wright was a very, very interesting fellow. He was a lawyer in Texas, I believe, who spent much of his life writing a gigantic book about an imaginary society on an island, kind of like if you imagine there was another Australia in the South Atlantic, a largish island, an agricultural, feudal utopia. And I read this, I think, at the age of about 17. I was very impressed, especially by their liberated sex life. Or, well, it wasn't that liberated, but it was very interesting to me at 17.
Mm-hmm.
And the question arises, well, can you have a modern, democratic, technologically advanced utopia, or I don't even like to call ecotopia utopia because it isn't perfect, obviously. It's evolving fast. It has all kinds of things still wrong with it. But at any rate, they're doing a whole lot of stuff differently. So I was stimulated to try and counter Skinner and Austin Wright. But for the positive things that I was inspired by, you know, I hadn't read, thank God I hadn't read Island by Aldous Huxley, because if I had, I probably would have thrown my manuscript away, because the plot line of that book and probably a dozen other utopias is so similar. You know, the outside person, a journalist or somebody, goes into the imaginary country, he finds out a lot of stuff about it, he begins to feel less skeptical about it, he may fall in love or he may get entangled in family feuds or who knows what kinds of complications, and in the end, he probably stays. Well, many, many authors have done this, and I did it automatically, I suppose, following the archetype.
Right.
And the spirit of the book, of course, people sometimes don't like that. They say, oh, it's so 60s or so 70s. And like any author, I absorbed a lot of ideas, of the feminist side of it especially, from the surrounding movements that were going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'd had a career as a student radical when I was at the University of Chicago, as sort of an anti-communist, left socialist type of thing. So I thought a lot about political evolution and what, you know, serious politics, not American-style politics, but real politics. And all those things came bubbling up. And it took a very, very, like I say, a very, very long time to get into gear with all this stuff. My favorite review was in a publication in Portland, Oregon called Rain, which was a journal of appropriate technology, they called it. And they reviewed the book and printed the forestry chapter in their magazine. And their review said, it looks easy, like the wheel. And I thought, oh.
That's good.
But it's not easy. When I get invited to lecture, I've been in Florida, for example, which is a totally different bioregion, of course, than what we have in the Northwest. And I would say to people, you know, you could make your own ecotopia. You could write your own ecotopia here and hopefully make it in a century or two. But so far, the only person who has done that is a professor of political science at the University of Hawaii, who wrote a book called Green Hawaii, which I really recommend reading. It's not a novel entirely like my book. It's about half a journalistic reportage about what really is under the surface, under the tourist surface of Hawaii, and of course a lot of it's not very pretty, and then talking about what might be done on the western end of Oahu to make a sort of an ecotopian community there. Mm-hmm. And he's lived there, I think, most of his life, so he really knows the ground and was able to make quite a convincing, I mean, it's a little bit like ecotopia in many ways, but in other ways it's very Hawaiian. And I wish every region in the world ought to start thinking like this. You know, the old saying, where there there is no vision, the people perish is perfectly true, as far as I can tell. So every region needs to get started thinking about what kind of a vision is appropriate to where they are, what their basic resources are, what their culture is like, what their potentials are.
And you mentioned in the novel that in the Northwest, we're advantaged by the climate, so that immediately Ecotopia is able to export food. It's producing more than it needs. But it would be a very different novel if it were set in Maine or Vermont. So.
Yeah, indeed. There could be people sometimes call Vermont Ecotopia East. I mean, people are both going back and forth both ways. But it's interesting to think of Ecotopia in really extreme climates. I mean, you could look at Israel, for example, from the beginning, not thinking about recent Israeli history. Stay away from that. But when the Israelis got there, of course, they faced, when the Jews from Europe got there, they faced a very, very desolate situation and have done an astonishing job with it, with what was there.
Well, the Mormons in Utah as well made the desert green.
So why did you decide to do this in novel form as opposed to a series of essays? You had a lot of ideas about the ideals or various units of a society that you could see that needed improvement. Why a novel?
Well, you know, I was a film critic. I ran a magazine called Film Quarterly for many years, and I have a very literal mind. I can't believe anything unless I can visualize it. And the ordinary nonfiction book tends to be quite abstract, quite formal, and you might say, lack juice. So when I started, I wrote all the news story parts of the book first, though, the reports that the narrator sends back to his paper. And then I showed these reports to some dear friends of mine in San Francisco. I used to have lunch regularly with them in North Beach, and they looked at it and said, well, who's writing this stuff? And I said, well, I don't know, some kind of journalist, some reporter or something. And they said, well, we want to know about him. We want to know about his life. Does he have a wife? Does he have a sex life? Where does he come from? You know, what's going on here? And I said, well, I couldn't write that. You know, I'm not a novelist. And they said, you ought to try. So
nice.
I sat down and thought I'd give it a whirl. And I was at that point getting divorced. And the idea that I could give my narrator hero a really wonderful woman to take up with made me feel a lot better, since my own personal life was in disarray. And that gave me the... And also the idea that it could have a diary part gave me the idea that the formal reports and the diary parts could kind of bounce back and forth and maybe undermine each other a little bit or reflect on each other or at least explore different corners that a straight-through account couldn't do. So that made it a little... I mean, it's not a terribly well-written, let's face it, it's not a terribly well-written novel or anything, but in that respect, it's a little bit of a modern novel, so I'm very glad I hit on that.
I think the structure of the novel works really well. I like those interactions between the narrative voice and the kind of description of this culture.
There are people who just read all of one or all of the other.
It could be
which
one.
I really like
it. You know, there is a masterpiece of literature by Ursula Le Guin called Always Coming Home. And it's similar in structure. There is a through story of the narrator's name is Stone Teller, as I recall, and you can follow, you could read nothing but the accounts of her life and its various tumultuous changes, or you could read that, leave out all the things about the whaling.
I wonder if we could talk for our listeners about a couple specifics in Ecotopia. You've already suggested what they do with sewage. Could we talk about their food or their plastic, which is a chapter that especially interested us, or any of the other chapters that come to mind?
Well, you know, I'm very interested in technology. I'm not at all anti-technology. I'm against bad technology that harms either human beings or, as it generally does, both human beings and other living beings. And what I've tried to do in all the aspects of the book is to try to imagine social systems, social institutions, and technological systems that are life-supporting rather than life-constraining or life-destroying. So in plastics, for example, most of our plastics now are derived from fossil fuel, either natural gas or petroleum. But it's perfectly possible, and we're now seeing products, of course, like this appearing. You can make plastics out of mostly, I guess, cellulose-type raw materials. And they can both be made biosource, that is to say they're not fossil fuel, they're from something that grows and that can therefore be carbon neutral, but they can also be designed chemically, structurally, to biodegrade, which means essentially to break down into some form that microorganisms can eat and transform back into basic nutrient substances. So this, even in the 1970s, all the science of this was known in a general way, and I just wanted to imagine that it actually had been put into practice, which that's one piece of good news we can look at, that 15 years ago about some companies put out allegedly biodegradable bags. I remember I buried one out here in my yard. I buried half of it, and I left the other half out in the sun. And, of course, what happened, the ultraviolet from the sun fragmented the visible parts into little teeny pieces, which maybe is a good thing, I suppose, or a very limited good thing. But when you lifted up the soil, the part that was buried was as good as when it came out of the factory, so it didn't although it kept it damp, so the microorganisms probably tried nibbling on it, but they couldn't get at it. But there are biodegradable plastics now that are apparently much better. I haven't repeated the experiment. I probably ought to.
Well, there's some that actually break down altogether and become, you know, their constituent biological parts, and there's some that just break down into tinier pieces of, like, the petroleum-based plastics that just persist.
Well, we needed to go through the, you know, in a way, I have this other book called Ecology, a Pocket Guide, and the unseen heroes of the world's ecology are microorganisms, and in this case, well, there are detritivores, which are things that chew or eat and so on. They're biggish. But when you get down to the real nitty-gritty of the biochemistry of life on Earth, it's the fungi that turn existing structures into raw materials for a new round of growth. And we all ought to honor structure, not only, you know, mushrooms on our pizza, but they're the ones who keep the world going. If it wasn't for fungi, the world would be stacked up with dead organisms, and there'd be nothing for anybody to eat.
Right. Other systems or other technology. I was describing the novel to my daughter and saying that some technologies are hugely advanced and some go back to American Indian ways of doing things, technologies. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the decision about what technologies to push forward and what technologies to conserve.
Well, I didn't at that time have access to a lot of information technology, but the Ecotopians did have picture phones, which are a lot better than ours. And the reason why they were interested in developing and using those was that they understood that it took a lot of energy and trouble to move a body from point A to point B. And if all you were trying to do was to negotiate a business deal or settle some family decision or something, it didn't make any sense to travel by any technological means. It might make sense to walk across the village, but to go, you know, to the other end of the state or something is crazy. So, and they also had very high-speed trains for those occasions when they had to go. So, you know, building the train from Sacramento to San Diego would be a very Ecotopian thing to do. We hope it happens in our lifetime. There are a couple of examples of Ecotopian technology that actually happened or are happening, and I'm very proud and happy to see that. Book, as I was a book publisher as well as a magazine editor for my whole life, and what is happening now in terms of e-books or whatever they're being called, the books that are read on e-readers like iPad or Kindle or so on, is very like what I imagined in Ecotopia. In Ecotopia, you go into a library or a post office or a school or maybe just standing on the street and you'll see a thing that looks kind of like a large Xerox machine or a jukebox. And in it you could see all that we basically see when we go on Amazon. You could see excerpt, you know, sample pages. You can see jacket blurbs and reviews and so on and so forth. If you wanted it in the book, I have people putting in quarters. That's a very quaint note. But there is now a thing which you can Google and see the picture of. It's called the Book Machine, and it does exactly that. And also, of course, people are now downloading books onto their readers, which in a way is a much simpler thing and probably lighter ecologically in its impacts ecologically than having printed books popped out of a machine would be. Although we have to remember that nothing in information technology is that light. The right. consumption of electricity in these server farms and many other aspects of IT are immense, and the manufacturing of electronic devices is extremely heavy impact.
Right.
Let's take a short break and come back and talk with you a little more about Ecotopia and the world today. We're with Ernest Kallenbach, author of Ecotopia.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and we are celebrating the 100th program of Ecotopia by featuring an interview with Ernest Kallenbach, author of Ecotopia, the book from which our show takes its name. We'll listen to the second half of the interview. We are talking with Ernest Kallenbach. He is the author of Ecotopia, which gave us the inspiration for the name of our show, obviously. And we are talking about the novel a little bit more before we get into Mr. Kallenbach's ideas about how we stand today. And there were two things that stood out for me in the novel. One of them was the chapter on ritual war games in Ecotopia, where young men participate in primitive warfare with spears that injure. Actually, hurt. People are hurt, and sometimes they can even die. Do you believe that humans need this kind of ritual violence? How did that become part of your vision of this improved society?
Well, I don't know how much you hang around with teenage boys. I've just been talking to my son about some of the escapades that he and his buddies, unbeknownst to me at the time, engaged in here in highly civilized Berkeley when they were young men. I mean, young men like to do the darndest dangerous things, and sometimes they get badly hurt. And if you watch the, I'd like to watch this atrocious program, America's Funniest Home Videos, where people do these horribly destructive things, and presumably the ambulance comes, and but it's always cut off. The scene is always cut off before the ambulance comes.
I'll just inject, there's also the show called Jackass, where young men deliberately do wild and dangerous things. Same spirit.
So the question of whether young men in particular, and a few young women, are daredevils and like to do really stupid things has to be answered. Yes, indeed, they do. They are. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably universal all over the world, although maybe here in America we're privileged to be even worse about it. But the actual inspiration for the scene came from a film, a very interesting film called Dead Birds, which is an ethnographic documentary by Robert Gardner from Harvard. And he went to part of New Guinea where there is a tribe called the Dani, D-A-N-I. And this was probably made in right before I wrote the book, probably late 60s, early 70s. The Dani have had at that time still continued ritual warfare. And actually, the scene as I portray it in the novel is almost a direct steal from the film. My reasoning was this. I was partly inspired by Margaret Mead, who is an anthropologist that I greatly admire, although she didn't like this film for, I think, very curious, funny reasons. The Dani fight because they like to fight. Margaret Mead said, well, what are they fighting about? They're not fighting about land. They're not fighting about, you know, stealing wives. They don't have gold. What are they fighting about? That's precisely the point. That people are moderately aggressive, as you see when you watch, as we were saying, young men. We're not like these fish that defend their little rock to the death or anything like that. But we and our primate relatives are moderately defensive about our territories. We like to keep others off them. And so I was imagining what would happen if you took, for example, the institution of American football. And we have to remember that in high school football, many young men have their backs broken and their necks broken and their bodies wrecked in high school football every year. So what would happen if you had a channel through which this part of our nature, as far as we can tell, it is part of our nature, could be expressed in a controlled and, in this case, non-fatal way for the most part, since these wounds with the spears are mostly light and they have antibiotics like we do. I was imagining that this might become a sort of a tribal ritual. Or you could imagine, like, in industrial areas, factories have teams. You know, they'll have a softball team, a bowling team, touch football teams, I don't know, well, most of which are not terribly dangerous. But the spirit is the same, us against them. Humans like to have us against them. And in many ways, ecotopian life is more tribal than ours. It's smaller scale. People live in smaller units. Their bonds with each other are probably a good deal more intense than most of our bonds are, and they might enjoy getting off in this kind of a way. The strategy of ecotopian social, whatever you want to call it, patterning or control, is always that people are kind of irregular. You know, we're not like cats or something that have a very fixed way of living and we seldom have anything to do with each other. We're very chummy and spontaneous and playful, and we like to do irregular things. And we're kind of mischievous and not terribly monogamous and all that stuff. So the ecotopian say, well, what do you do to make the society stable, even though the people that make it up aren't that stable? Well, in the case of sex, they have these carnival holidays four times a year on the solstices and the equinoxes, in which times more or less anything goes. I mean, there's some people would be very cautious about it, some people would be very reckless about it, but there's permission in a society to be reckless and irresponsible for a couple of days during those periods. And that's what I was trying to do with the ritual war, to suggest that it's possible for people in a society to do kind of crazy and irresponsible things, so long as they don't do it all the time, so long as it's institutionalized in a way that makes it, you know, kind of festive, probably great fun most of the time, but then normal life also continues in the intervals. So that's what I was trying. That was what I was trying to do at any rate.
Right.
By the way, when I'm giving lectures in a, for example, a college campus, usually there's a question: how about this ritual war? And one of the questions that I ask the audience is, how many of the women in the audience would like to participate in ritual war if such a thing existed? And there are usually a couple of women who are kind of athletes, kind of jockish women who are really, you know, strong and adventurous and want to test themselves physically. And they say, well, yeah, I'd kind of like to try that. So I was probably mistaken to have only young men doing it in Ecotopia.
Interesting.
Well, there is the phenomenon, too, of the roller derby in our time, which is coming back, where women get to do something very like ritual warfare.
Another aspect of the novel that really interested me is how you handled race. The African Americans in the novel have seceded from Ecotopia and have created their own societies within Ecotopia. And no mention of Latinos at all, nothing from south of the border. A little bit of talk about a Chinatown that also seems to be comparable to the African-American communities. And I'm wondering, number one, how you conceived of that, and number two, if you would conceive of it differently if you were writing the novel today.
Well, let me tell you the background of it. I was mentioning that I was a student radical, and one of the things you learn as a student radical is that there has been a movement around for a long time called Black cultural nationalism.
Marcus Garvey.
And a lot of other things, too. For example, for a certain period in the 30s, it was argued that the states of Mississippi and Alabama, which were heavy black majority states, should become black states. Tell the whites, you know, move someplace else if possible, or if they liked it, say, but at any rate, it would be that the power in the state would sort of like what happened in South Africa. The power structure would switch over. And at the time I was writing, if you sat down and said, has integration worked? and you were a smart black person with access to all the statistics, you would have to say, not very well, because the gap between blacks and whites was then widening, and it has widened much more since then. We now have more of a black, it's still tiny, but we have more of a black middle class than we had then. Obviously, we had no black president, or I think no black senators, and probably only one or two black representatives in Congress. So it would be possible for black people, and also something had happened that was a lot closer to home. In San Francisco, for example, in the Fillmore, there had been a very well-developed and rich, not financially rich necessarily, but culturally rich mm-hmm. neighborhood with every conceivable kind of store, a lot of entertainment venues, a great mix of classes and types of people there. And that was all wiped out by urban redevelopment. And a few blacks who could afford it moved to the suburbs or elsewhere. And the black communities were kind of disemboweled by various of those forces. So looking at the world in the, from that standpoint in 1971, it was not terribly apparent that integration was such a hot ideal after all. I was, at that time when I was living in California, I was a strong integrationist. And if I was living in Akatopia, I would probably say to black people who said, hey, we're getting ready to secede, I say, wait a minute, let's give it a generation, because we've made, after all, some progress, and maybe it could work out all right. But since the principle of the nation was to secede from the mother country, or what we mm-hmm. now call the homeland, they could hardly turn around and say to their black citizens, right. You can't secede, we're the only ones who could secede. So I imagined that heavy concentrations of black people might live in, I forget what geographic area I envisaged for it, but I had lived in mostly black neighborhoods here in Berkeley, and, you know, as a white person, I have my own racist components, certainly, and I discovered, to my great surprise, that my black neighbors weren't terribly interested in me. I mean, white people are pretty boring to most blacks. I had quite wonderful black neighbors who lived very vivid and emotionally exciting and full lives, whereas my wife and I, you know, I was an academic editor and she was going through graduate school, and our kids, although they were sweet, were kind of, you know, probably to the average black kid of their age, not very active or enterprising or interesting. And I had to realize that there's a much bigger cultural gulf between the way black people live emotionally and the way white people live emotionally than I had ever imagined. I mean, just as a sort of middle-class intellectual as I am. And I had to think about that. You know, if blacks had the choice between living in a world where most people around were blacks and behaved like they behaved, maybe that would be a happier life than living in a life where, because of the power structure inherent in the black-white thing, they had to always be careful. And one of the formative influences in this, by the way, was going to the island of Antigua in the West Indies. I had a friend from Stanford who had been born and grew up there, and he invited me down there for a couple of weeks one summer. And it's very shocking, whether you're an American white or an American black, it turns out, to go to a country which is totally black, where everybody is black, and the only place you see whites is in the bank of tourists coming mm-hmm. to get their money out. Antigua was that time only about 70,000 people, but it was a little country, a miniature country. And that was important for Ecotopia, too, because it made me think again that small countries, and Ecotopia is a pretty small country, 15 million people, small countries can be really neat. They're not mm-hmm. big enough to try to have big armies or try mm-hmm. to throw their weight around in the world. They, on the whole, tend to take care of their people better. And being in Antigua like that made me see that black life could have a unity and a character and a wholeness about it that it's hard to imagine just looking at blacks in America, who are always living in this looking uphill toward the white power, toward the man attitude. And a young black woman from New York had come down about at the same time we were there, and she found this blackness so shocking, and the fact that blacks had all the power and ran everything, she couldn't stand it. I'm not quite sure why, but she got on the plane after a couple of days and went back to New York. Yeah. It was really just somehow didn't seem right to her. You know, she had adjusted to life in New York, which is, after all, a pretty liberal city, and black life there is reasonably tolerable, most of it. But it just threw her off the track. And I thought about that a lot. And then I thought, well, maybe separation, mm-hmm. although our instinct is to say we all ought to be jumbled up and mixed up and so on, is maybe that's, especially for a culture where things are relatively intense and villagey, and people live in these huge apartments with, you know, several generations of, you know, extended family and so on. Maybe a separation that had a racial component is not a bad thing either. And then, in reply to your question about Chinese, if you say blacks might want to succeed, well, right. Chinese might too. Let's see, there was something.
Latinos.
Oh, the reason Latinos don't figure in the book is that I was writing in the 70s when Southern California had a large Latino population.
Right.
But once you got to the Salinas Valley and north, there were very few then. It's changed enormously since then. Uh-huh. And in other parts of the country, too, of course.
I want to have us change gears just a little bit. Here's my impossibly broad question. You said you were discouraged when you started writing the book in 1971. What is your state of encouragement or discouragement some 30 or 40 years later?
Well, I vary from total despair to relative cheerfulness. The relative cheerfulness comes from the fact that I grew up in the country, and if you live on the land, as I did in a way, you gain a great respect for the ability of the biological world to not so much defend itself, but to recover. I mean, if you look at Vietnam, even, where we poured untold, I don't know, millions of gallons of Agent Orange and so on, trying to defoliate the whole country. It's coming back pretty well. The mangrove forests are not. I have a friend who's an expert in this, but the agricultural lands and so on have recovered pretty well. So if human beings can somehow stop wrecking the place, maybe it will come back and be capable of supporting us for a long time. When you look at what's happening in the political structure, or, you know, things like the daily news, you can hardly be anything but profoundly depressed, because we are in a declining empire, and I think that things are probably going to get very ugly socially. They are certainly very ugly ecologically, and there are spots where things, wonderful things happen, and maybe more wonderful things will happen, but on the whole, it's pretty depressing. I sometimes think of writing a book called After Ecotopia, which would be about the real likely future of the species, I guess you would say. On the other hand, you have to look at it this way. Things decline. You go down the sliding board, but at the bottom of the sliding board, it kind of veers up a little bit, and you leap off into space, and with luck, maybe even stand up again and run. I was just watching a bunch of kids do this the other day. And what we can hope, I mean, people talk about a hard landing versus a soft landing, and the hard landing means that industrial consumer capitalism somehow overshoots itself, or, well, we know it has overshot, but it loses its sustaining, mostly petroleum, underpinnings, and goes down with a bang. And there's some wonderful books by James Kunstler and various other people. There's a whole school of thought called, Dmitry Orlov, what do they call themselves? Catastrophists, I think. And they delight in imagining how things are going to get unimaginably worse very fast. I think things are very likely to get unimaginably worse, but probably with painful slowness, because on the whole, human affairs move a lot slower than we would like, both for the good and for the bad. But the conclusion I draw from all this, to and fro, is that we all do what we can. And in a way, when we lose faith in the power of the national government to do good things, which a lot of Americans, not only Greens like me, but, you know, even Tea Party members and so on, when we lose faith in the power of governments to do things, it behooves us that we'd better get busy and do those things for ourselves. And that could be very useful in developing sort of ecotopian patterns of life and human interaction.
And you've seen ecotopian intentional communities. You wrote about one in Japan just a few years ago and have visited others. Could you talk a little bit about communities that you've seen, where you've seen the principles in operation, and particularly what kinds of bumps were there in the road as these societies get started?
Well, there's probably no really ecotopian community anywhere on the planet yet, and God knows there may never be. The one I visited in Japan, part of the Yamagishi movement, and the big community is called Toyosato, is quite ecotopian in its agricultural operations. It's not very ecotopian in its energy use, because in Japan, as here, if you're a really big, heavy energy use, like a factory or something, you get cheaper rates. Mm-hmm. So they use a lot of power, they use a lot of gas. They have a lot of cars, as a matter of fact, because they need to get around a lot. But what's happening in this country is that there are a lot of eco-villages around. There are also co-housing communities. I think somebody had a big one planned for Chico somewhere that didn't come, south of town somewhere that didn't come into being as yet. But there are a lot of them out there, and they are certainly a good thing. The problem is that most of us live in cities, and the ecotopia is sometimes taken to be a back to land book, but it's not. It's an ecological, sustainable cities book, really, and that's why I spend so much time talking about what San Francisco, the capital of ecotopia, was like in ecotopian circumstances. And there has been, since ecotopia came out, quite a revolution in the thinking, at least, of city planners and many city officials. They now understand that the car is not your friend if you're
right.
a city,
mm-hmm.
and that some means has to be found to dependize ourselves from cars. And there's the good side of making cities very congenial without people having to rely on cars, making them more dense so that more things that you want and need are nearby. Richard Register, a comrade of mine who wrote EcoCity, a book called EcoCities, has a wonderful slogan. He says what we need is access by proximity.
Right.
Not
mm-hmm.
any kind, even if cars ran on air, we would be better off without cars. And he's, I think, dead right. We need to rethink our whole idea of what cities are like. And it's funny because we are going back to approximately what the Italians did in the 1400s. You know, a four-story, Richard doesn't mind 14 stories, but to me, four or five stories is fine. But very dense, where people see each other all the time, where they're visibly, I mean, we like to think we're not reliant on each other. Americans particularly have this idiotic idea that, you know, we're strong individuals, we don't need anybody. Well, it's cuckoo, but when you live in a city with a lot of other people around, it's plain to you every moment of every day how much you need each other and how much you get from each other. So there's been quite a movement toward densification and infill in cities, and people like Kunstler, of course, believe that the suburbs are just going to die on the vine, and all mm-hmm. those McMansions are just going to rot.
Mm-hmm.
What seems to be happening is that they're being chopped up into apartments and things like that. There are certain suburban shopping mall centers that may become town centers. They may become genuine plazas in the European sense, where almost everything people need can be obtained, and maybe the part that survives will be the part that's within walking distance of such centers. So our suburbs may not collapse, but sort of, what do you call it when oil, they may coagulate.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that could be very interesting.
Interesting.
So you talk about how this has happened in some places. Is there something that can be done to push more in that direction? Is this going to be solved by individual communities? Is it going to be helped at all by government through incentives or rewards programs or regulation or mandates? How do you see us able to push more in those directions that you see as healthy and communal?
Well, governments can do useful and interesting things. Like about two blocks from my house here, for example, there's a Pete's Coffee Shop mm-hmm. where I buy my coffee beans.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bulb, what traffic planners call a bulb, out in front of the store, which is a traffic prevents cars from going straight along the curve. They have to divert out into the street. And for about a year, Pete's was seeking permission from the Berkeley City government to put some chairs and tables out there so that people could take their coffee. and sit there in the fumes of the cars and drink their coffee. And finally, they got the permission and put these things out there. And it greatly helps that tiny little corner of Berkeley to be a more civilized and congenial sort of a place. And people instantly took advantage of it. People take advantage of any little corner. There's a pizza place down here, the Cheese Board Collective, which is still here after 30-some years of employee ownership, makes wonderful, wonderful pizzas. At the end of the day, in fact, sometimes at noontime, there's a line of about 100 people waiting to get pizza there. But there's no place to sit down and eat it. The shop itself is a tiny little storefront. So what people do is go out and sit in the traffic meridian, which is grass with a few trees sticking up, and traffic, it's about maybe 10 or 12 feet wide, traffic zooming by, four lanes of two lanes each way, and they sit there and they eat their pizza, and it's a party scene. You know, they I could never tolerate all that exhaust fumes, but they don't seem to mind it. I don't know, maybe they've become immune to it or something. But it's a good example of how if the society provides little interstices, little open spots, people will take advantage of it. They like to hang around with each other. You go into a movie theater, and there are 500 seats, and everybody is sitting in the middle 100, say, because we like to be near each other. And a city is a living, breathing example of that. And wherever city managers, city officials can foster that, they'd be well off to do it, instead of keeping on making life easy for cars. You know, Houston is the abysmal example of what happens if you don't do that. There are large areas of downtown Houston where there are no sidewalks. You cannot get to certain places without being in a vehicle.
Amazing.
I mean, I suppose you could run like a rabbit across the...
Yeah, Phoenix has some of that as well.
Yeah. This is, I mean, that's just terrible.
As we close, I wonder if you have any other parting thoughts or hopes and dreams that you could inspire us with, though some of the things that you just said have done that.
Well, I want to say one thing about politics. Our government has been sort of taken over by corporate finance people who own pretty much lock and stock and barrel almost entirely the national legislature and most of many state legislatures, too. There's only one way that I know to get rid of that. It's the system that they use in Arizona and Maine and also, I believe, in Connecticut called clean elections, where candidates, they aren't forced to, but they may, if they wish, run using public funding, and many of them run against privately funded people and win. The result of this is that if you were elected, say, you would not have to be constantly looking over your shoulder to see whether your friendly funders are going to approve of a vote that you're planning to take. You could actually vote in what you see as the public interest. Now, you might be a, you know, extreme right-winger, extreme left-winger, an extreme moderate, who knows what. But you would be doing your legislative duty instead. You know, they say that representatives spend up to 80% of their time raising money, and only 20% of their time is spent actually deciding how to vote things, looking into issues, discussing with their staffs, and so on. That is a scandalous and ridiculous and paralyzing situation, because what it means is that legislatures cannot act in ways that offend any substantial funding source. Most of these funding sources, of course, are corporate. There are a few big unions and so on, too, but it's almost entirely corporate. And it's like American politics has become a sort of a pile of rocks. You know, when you pile a lot of odd-sized rocks together, they all just look like individual rocks. But in actual fact, if you try to move the pile, it won't budge because they're all locked in together. And our national political system is kind of like that. In California, the legislature, which does an occasional good thing, proposed that in the year 2014, the Secretary of State office, which is quite an important office, would be one in which you could run clean, as they say. You could get public funding to run for it. But it went up before the people in this last election and was shot down. Now, the only conclusion you can draw is that California voters do not understand that the legislators are bought by somebody besides them. Public elections are the only way in which ordinary people can buy legislatures, buy with quote marks around it. So I regard that as kind of the, like in college, a prerequisite when you can't take another course unless you do this prerequisite. Well, clean elections are kind of a prerequisite to Ecotopia or any other good thing. because otherwise you just get things like the health bill or the energy bill or the banking bill, which may do one or two minor good things, but on the whole, they keep the system in the pockets of the rich.
We want to thank you, Ernest Kallenbach, for talking with us tonight about Ecotopia and your other book, Ecotopia Emerging, which talks some about the ways in which Ecotopia came about. You've been an inspiration to us. We thank you so much for being with us.
It was fun.
Thank you.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and you are listening to our interview with Ecotopia author Ernest Kallenbach, celebrating the 100th edition of our show.
And we want to remind you that Ecotopia is made possible by men of our contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for our green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
Coming up at 7 this evening is a shortened version of The Storyteller with Adrian Scott, and then KZFR will take you live to the Big Room for an interview and concert with Daryl Scott, singer, songwriter, and master musician.
Stuff interspersed, and people do that with Moby Dick too, of course.